Welcome to FedSoc Forums, a podcast of the Federal Society's Practice Groups. I'm Nate Kazmarek, Vice President and Director of Practice Groups at the Federal Society. For exclusive access to live recordings of FedSoc Forum programs, become a Federal Society member today at fedsoc.org.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to this Federal Society virtual event. My name is Marco J. Lloyd, and I'm an Assistant Director of Practice Groups at the Federal Society. Today, we're excited to host a litigation update on Mid-Vermont Christian School v. Saunders, featuring David Cortman. David serves as Senior Counsel and Vice President of U.S. Litigation with Alliance Defending Freedom. He has been practicing law for over 25 years, litigating hundreds of constitutional law cases in federal and state courts. He won numerous major victories for religious liberties in the U.S. Supreme Court, successfully arguing Trinity Lutheran Church v. Comer and Reed v. Town of Gilbert. He also served as lead counsel on many more successful Supreme Court cases. Our moderator today is Eric Treen. Eric is senior counsel at Storzer & Associates in D.C., an adjunct professor and fellow at the Catholic University of America. He served for 19 years in the U.S. Department of Justice as special counsel for religious discrimination, where he provided leadership for the department on a wide range of religious liberty issues. Before joining the DOJ, he was litigation director at the Beckett Fund, and was a law clerk to the Honorable John M. Walker, Jr. on the Second Circuit Court of Appeals. If you'd like to learn more about today's speakers, their full bios can be viewed on our website, fedsoc.org. If you have a question at any point in today's program, please enter it into the Q&A function at the bottom of your Zoom window, and we'll do our best to answer as many as we can. Finally, I'll note that, as always, the Federal Society takes no position on particular legal or public policy issues, and all expressions of opinion are those of the speakers. With that, Eric, thank you for joining us today, and the floor is yours.
Great. Well, thank you, Marco, and thanks to Federal Society for hosting this important discussion. So today we're going to be talking with David about his case, Mid-Vermont Christian Schools v. Saunders, an important case up in the Second Circuit now. It's regarding a Christian school in Vermont that's been kicked out of the state-run sports league because they forfeited a game because their girls' basketball team didn't want to play with a biological male who identifies as a girl. And this has led to a religious liberty suit and all kinds of interesting constitutional issues. But before we get into this particular case, David, you mentioned to me that there's some background here, some other cases that sort of set the stage for this case. Could you elaborate a little on that?
Yeah, thanks, Eric. I appreciate that. It's been interesting because this is actually the fourth case against Vermont and its agency of education. So the history goes back several years. In fact, it goes back several decades. Vermont is one of those states that has what's called a town tuitioning program that has various benefits to it. And so in those rural areas and rural states, they don't have public schools in every town. So what they do is they have sending towns, they call them. If they don't have a public school, you can go to any private school you want. They'll pay the tuition, unless, of course, if it's a religious school, and then they won't. So these are the throwback days of the Establishment Clause being really strict, even the state Blaine Amendments, they call them. And so the very first lawsuit was several years ago against the Agency of Education on that exact issue. One of it was the town tuitioning that I just described. Another one was dual enrollment, which people are familiar with. If you go to a high school, you can take college classes and you'll get credit for both. That dual enrollment program was also prohibited if you attended a religious high school. It was fine if you took a class at a religious college, but if you went to a religious high school, you were banned from that program. And that was the first several cases that we filed against Vermont and the Agency of Education.
Right. So what's going on here? What's the genesis of this dispute?
Yeah, interestingly, it's a follow-up or a continuation of those original cases. In fact, when we first filed this case on behalf of Mid-Vermont, they denied the town tuitioning again, even though this was the fourth time we were suing them over a similar issue, and they just keep coming up with new ways to do it. So this time what they did was, even though the court ruled against them the first three times, they added a non-discrimination clause that we're all familiar with. And they basically said that this religious school has to comply with public accommodation laws and couldn't, quote unquote, discriminate on the basis of sexual orientation and gender identity and other types of things. And then they required every religious school, every Christian school, to put that in their bylaws. And of course, this school had a religious objection, so they kicked them out of the program once again, which is what led to this case.
Great. What's the status of that funding issue now?
So the funding issue, while they first denied us, once we filed the lawsuit and then moved for a preliminary injunction, all of a sudden they had a change of heart and they said, no, you are approved for the funding. So that kind of set it aside on the case. They were supposed to pass new rules, they told the court, in June or July of last year. And even though we're on appeal, they still haven't put the new rules in place. So they basically told the court they'd have new rules. They don't. But that is still active in the case, but not on the appeal, because right now just being appealed is the preliminary injunction on the sports issue.
Yeah, well, let's turn to the PI. So what happened to you that, you know, this being, you know, forfeiting a game, getting kicked out of the league, how did this all unfold?
Yeah, it was interesting. Then the school really wrestled with it. But what happened was they were in the girls basketball during the season and in the tournaments. And it's a small community. So by word of mouth and other ways, they basically found out that there was this young man who was identifying as a girl who was playing on the women's basketball team. And he had a reputation, if any of you follow basketball, his nickname given to him by his coach, I believe, was "Not in My House." And what that basically means is if you drive on the ball into the hoop, you're going to get blocked. It's kind of like a Shaquille O'Neal type of thing. You go in, not in my house, it gets rejected. And so he's pretty physical of a player. The school said, look, we have two problems with this. One of them is we're concerned about the safety for our girls. It's unfair. He's bigger and taller and stronger. We don't want anybody to get hurt. And also it violates our religious beliefs to participate in this because we believe in immutability. There's only two sexes, male and female. It's not scientifically proper or possible to change from, you know, a female to a male or vice versa. And so we don't want to participate in that. And so we ask to just be able to forfeit that particular game that kicks them out of the tournament. So the punishment's already on them. So they basically said, look, we're going to forfeit. We'll take the loss. We know the season's over for us, but that's important enough for our religious beliefs. And that's what started it all off.
Right. And how did the school respond? I mean, how did the sports league respond?
Yeah, immediately and harshly. And that was probably the most surprising thing. They first started debating the religious beliefs of the school. They told them their beliefs were wrong. It doesn't violate your beliefs to do this, like telling the school what their religious beliefs were. Basically saying, look, there's other schools like BYU that's Mormon and they play Catholic schools and it doesn't violate their faith to do that. So basically you're wrong in your beliefs. But the most surprising part was the punishment they meted out, number one, had never been done before, and number two was the harshest penalty that they had. So they had discretion to say, okay, what's, first of all, if there is any penalty at all, and second of all, what would it be? And they basically, so the VPA, the Vermont Principals Association, is what runs all competitions, athletics, all sports, quiz bowl, debate club, so both academics and sports leagues. And once you join the VPA, you're allowed in all those. Well, they kicked them out of everything. So not just women's basketball, every single sport, every single academic competition, you name it, they were completely banned, even though they were part of this for the last like 25 or 30 years.
Now, you've brought a constitutional claim. That's the basis for your request for the PI. But why is a sports league that includes public and private schools a state actor that you can sue under the Constitution?
Yeah, it's a great question and an important point. So what's interesting is the VPA, as I mentioned, they're actually set up as a private, I believe it's a 501c3, but as a private corporation. One of the things that we're trying to work on and tackle are these private organizations across the country that dictate not only sports leagues, but dictate careers, the medical field, attorneys. They're all these private organizations, and so the Constitution technically doesn't apply to them, but yet they wield the power of the government. They could ban you from engaging in a career. They could ban you from all sports. And so we thought it important to say, well, look, they're technically a private not-for-profit, but this is a government actor. They're given the power of the government. And so we brought the case, making the argument that they're a state actor for a bunch of different reasons. And people may be familiar. There's a Brentwood case and other cases out there. But what we argued was, look, they're all, this VPA is made up of 99% public school principals, superintendents. All their money comes from public schools. So even though there's some private school members, the board and all the finances come in large part, 90-something percent from government money. They're government actors, they're state actors. And so we made the argument that they are indeed state actors and are subject to the Constitution.
Is this a heavily contested point in the litigation, or is it more the free exercise issues, which we'll turn to in a moment?
So surprisingly, they didn't really contest it. We expected a pretty big fight going in. In fact, our complaint has dozens of paragraphs about all the facts I mentioned, where their funding comes from, who the board is made up of, who were members of it, just to show all the facts from case law that they truly are a state actor. But much to our surprise, they really didn't seriously contest the issue through the litigation.
Yeah, no. In a constitutional case, there's either going to be a showing of some kind of burden, whether it's substantial or something less than that. But I understand you all, there's a Christian sports league that you can join. What is the real injury to your school here?
Yeah. It's interesting because it's one of the arguments the other side brought up too, and it's a good point. I guess it's the, I don't know if it's the separate but equal reference. So there's no real punishment here because you can go do it somewhere else is kind of the theory. No punishment if you're not in this league because you can go join another league. Well, on the bigger picture, let's take that logic for a second and just talk about it. So you're not going to be allowed to use this public park because you're having a church service or you're doing something religious, but you know there's another one, you know, down the block or in the next town. Just go use that one. There's really no harm. So the principle of it is that, and there's case law that says this, and there's a Schneider versus State from many decades ago, but it basically says you can't violate your constitutional rights on the plea that they may be exercised elsewhere. And so the injury is, it's not that you can't do any sport anywhere, but this is a public benefit. This VPA league, the sports league, the academic competitions. And the question is, can you be denied this public benefit because you might be able to get some private or other benefit somewhere else? So it's really a completely separate question about whether you're able to join another league or whether you're able to have some sort of, even if it's comparable, which this other league isn't, is it still a violation of your rights to be kicked out of this one because of religious beliefs? And the answer is clearly yes, under Supreme Court case law. And I would add, as a practical difference, it's not the same. There's a lot of travel involved. They have to go to different states. They have to miss school. It costs them more money, more time, miss classes. They don't have the variety of sports. They don't have the academic competitions. So it's not even close to being equal. It's clearly not on the same level as the state league. And then the prestige, third of all, for the students. When you go to school, and especially athletes who maybe want to get into college, there's a big difference between playing in a small Christian league that goes out of state and the league from the state if you're looking at going to college and move. So there's a lot of different injuries separate and apart from the constitutional one, which basically overshadows the rest.
Sure. Now, David, you mentioned that this particular biological boy was a strong player, not in my house, rejected, you know, blocking shots. What if this were just a bench warmer, a very slight male who wasn't that great at basketball anyway, who just wants to be on the team? Would that be a reason for objection by your client?
It would be. And the reason for that is, as I mentioned before, there's two types of considerations. One of them is fairness, safety, danger to the girls. In that particular situation, that might not be an issue, depending on those factors that you mentioned. But the more important of the two issues is the religious beliefs, and that's still at issue. And that is, we don't want to participate, condone, where there's a young man who's identifying as a girl, and we don't want to participate in that because it violates our religious beliefs because of what I mentioned. That's still at issue, even separate and apart from, is there a safety factor or is there any hazard in playing? And of course, that would be at issue. So the objection would still be there in that particular case.
Well, let's turn to the meat of the constitutional argument here. I mean, most of our viewers are probably familiar with free exercise law generally, but tell me, you know, we have the Smith decision, you know, generally applicable neutral laws. This seems to be a neutral law, right? Nobody can discriminate against transgender kids. It's an important value in the state of Vermont. Why doesn't Smith control? I mean, this isn't RFRA. There's no state law at issue. How do you get out of the Smith box and into strict scrutiny here?
Yeah, and that's an important question because it's not only what the other side argued, it's what the court ruled. And so that's how we lost the case, is the court basically said, look, this goes under Smith. It's neutral and generally applicable. It applies across the board to everyone. And so you're under rational basis, and under rational basis you lose. So is the argument in the case, if you will. So there's a couple of points in response. I think the easiest one on the case law post-Smith is if there's, and this is the Fulton case and the Tandon case, you know, some of the COVID cases, is there an individualized assessment? And this was even talked about even in the Smith case. Is there an individualized assessment where a decision is made on a case-by-case basis? And here, what we thought was one of the stronger arguments were, there's an individualized assessment on like four or five different layers. So sometimes, like in the Fulton case, there was an individualized assessment, and the government there argued, well, we never even used it. And just the fact that it existed in the policy was enough to bring it to strict scrutiny. Here, we've got like four or five levels of individualized assessment, and I'll go through those real quickly because it kind of explains the strength of the argument in response to the other side's position. The first thing is, which is I thought the most important thing we found, in the policies themselves, the VPA who runs all the athletics and the competitions, their main policy is, look, we have our overall policy is we want to make sure that we separate boys from girls. We want to give girls athletic opportunities. We don't want the boys coming in and taking over. And so our main overarching policy is, we're going to separate boys and girls in sports. And we're thinking, well, that's exactly what we're trying to say. But then over the last year, they made an exception to that policy. So individualized assessment, case by case assessment, number one is, so now we're going to make an exception in some sports to say, well, we want those, you know, those boys who identify as girls to be able to play. So now we're going to make exceptions from our general policy. Well, the next layer is, each individual school handles that decision on a case-by-case basis. So it starts at whatever school you attend, and if there's an athlete who identifies as transgender, that starts at the school, and the school could either say, yes, you're allowed to, or for all these factors, say, no, you can't. That decision could be appealed to the VPA, which is another layer of a case-by-case basis. Adding to that, the argument made, which we were also a little surprised, was they said that any religious school doesn't have to comply with this policy with their own teams. So your own team doesn't have to comply with that, but yet you do when you play somebody else. So we have down to a fifth level. So the policy top to bottom is, look, we have this main goal of boys and girls being separated. We'll make an exception to that in some instances, not all sports, some sports. And then we'll make an exception to that on a case-by-case basis. And then we'll review it on appeal on a case-by-case basis. And by the way, we won't make you do that. And on top of it, I don't know if it's the cherry on top or the icing on the cake, whatever expression you want to use, the VPA has the ability to waive any policy. And so they can just say, no, in this particular situation, we're not doing it all. So we thought with all those levels, somebody's going to buy into one of those and get us to strict scrutiny under the Fulton case. But I've been unsuccessful so far.
Okay. Now let's suppose you do get to strict scrutiny. Vermont is a democracy. You know, it's a state. It has its own sovereignty. If it decides that transgender is, based on their view of human rights and so forth, is a very highly protected category, akin to discrimination based on ethnicity and religion and race and so forth. Why aren't they entitled to do that?
I guess the shortest answer I could give is the supremacy clause, but I'll talk about that a little bit. They are certainly welcome to do so up until the point where it violates a federal constitutional right is the easiest thing to talk about in this situation. So they can have that as state public policy. They can implement that in areas where they want to. But once that delineation then steps on, interferes, conflicts with some federal constitutional right here, for example, the Free Exercise Clause, then under the Supremacy Clause, it has to give way. And so that's why this whole balancing of, okay, what's the government interest here? What's the conflict with a federal constitutional right here, the Free Exercise Clause? And then when you wrestle all that out, who comes out on top?
Right. But if it was deemed a compelling interest by a federal court, then you wouldn't have the Supremacy Clause argument, right?
If they were able to get to that level, and there's a bunch of reasons why we don't think they can. And while we're on it, we'll just talk about that for a minute. So what's interesting is case law basically says if the government has exceptions if it brooked no departure. Well, if it does have exceptions and does have departures, that undermines the compelling nature of its interest. So if there are certain instances where the government says, oh, this is compelling, and we're old enough to be like compelling interest used to be like your national security, and like that was it. Now we seem to have a lot of compelling interest, but that's probably a conversation for another day. So you have more things that reach to a compelling interest. But here, if you make exceptions to such an important interest, then really, is it that important? So if the government itself is undermining its own interest, that then kind of basically says to the court, it's not as compelling as you say, because you are making exceptions. And in this particular case, as I mentioned, there's layer upon layer upon layer of exceptions to the supposing compelling interest. And so even though they would make the argument, that wouldn't be able to stick because it's not across the board because of all these case by case exceptions.
And for example, as you said, the way that a school can make its own choice with its own players, if it's going to allow boys to play on girls' teams and so forth. So that would be built into that. Okay, but then there's the parade of horribles, right? So you're going to be ready for this, and it's not going to be a surprise to you, but I can imagine a Christian school that said, a very fundamentalist school that said, you know what? Only boys should play sports. Girls should not. And what if the sports league had a rule that, you have to provide sport. If you're going to be in our sports league, you got to provide opportunities equally for boys and girls. If it's girls basketball, there has to be boys basketball. There has to be girls basketball and so forth. What if they said you can't be this fundamentalist school cannot be in our league because they don't offer girls sports? Is that allowed or is?
Yeah, I mean, setting the whole Title IX question aside, it would depend. And here's what I mean by that. So they would still have to recognize it as being a religious belief. They can't do what they did here and say your beliefs are wrong, which is the wrong place to start out. But then you would look at, what's the government interest here? And are there any exceptions? And would it really matter if, for example, a particular school said, we have boys teams, we could put them in the leagues. Does it change the scheduling? Does it do anything to the league itself? Like, what's the compelling interest other than, we want to have girls be able to play sports too? So you would go through the same particular analysis of recognize it's a religious belief. Do you get to strict scrutiny in the first place? Are there case-by-case basis? Are there individualized assessments? Here it's a lot easier because there's so many layers of doing so. If that translated to your hypo, then you'd come out the same place and say, we have girls and boys teams everywhere, except we don't need to have them here, here, and here. That would obviously undermine their interest, and then it would have to allow it. But if it was straight across the board, there were no exceptions, and they could prove some compelling government interest, I'm not sure what that would be, then they may be able to require it.
And, then there's always the race question comes up. What if there's a school that said, our religious beliefs, races shouldn't mix, and therefore we're going to forfeit a game because we don't want to play against a black player?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, that is what's interesting about that. It's the hypo. that you're discussing before you go to court on any one of our cases, right? Are any of the judges going to ask the question? Most of the time it doesn't come up. And the reason for that is it doesn't really happen anymore, but every once in a while it still does, interestingly enough. And I think the first response in this particular case is that under this individualized assessment that there is in this case, it's an easier question, even though it's very weighty. It would be like the government saying, you can't have any racial discrimination, but we'll allow it in all these circumstances, just not with you because of your religion. So in this particular case, that would be a lot easier to weigh down because it makes exceptions, as we've talked about. A little bit tougher is if there aren't any and it's straight across the board, but then you've got cases that, like Bob Jones, who've gone through that already, and the court said, look, because of the history of our country, the nature of racial discrimination and slavery and the war and, you know, all these different things, it's such a weighty interest that's different from all these other categories we have. And so, for example, that likely would be a compelling government interest, and it's very possible that the religious school in that case would lose on the claim because of the history, because of the case law, because of what the Supreme Court has said. The good thing is you don't see that much anymore. I haven't seen it in decades in doing this sort of work, and that's a good thing. But it's obviously still something there that has to be addressed.
Yeah, I mean, in your case, whenever these cases get up to the Supreme Court, people talk about, well, should Smith be overruled and so forth? Is that on the table in this case? Is this something you might say Smith should be overruled if you're not going to give us strict scrutiny for these reasons? Is that something to consider?
It is. And what we do is, you know, the lower courts don't have any power, obviously, to overrule Smith. Only the Supreme Court does. So you can make the argument, but they'll just say, that's great, but we can't do anything about it. But we always try to preserve it, even if it's just a footnote, just to say, look, you know, we think this is not neutral and generally applicable. But even if you think it is, and even if you apply Smith, we're going to argue, you know, later on that it should be overruled. So we always hang on to that because you never know if and when the court's going to be ready to do so. Here, the court has really, over the past decade, has limited Smith greatly. Just keeps narrow, which I think what the chief does pretty often, which I think is important, kind of an incrementalist approach. But yeah, we always try to keep that on the table for when the court's ready, just to say, okay, we're done with this, and here's what we're going to replace it with, which was one of the questions I think in Fulton on all the opinions was, well, what do we replace it with? And there was a debate about that. And so you got to.
I mean, what would you replace it with? Do you need a substantial burden, and then it triggers strict scrutiny, or certain kinds of burden in certain situations, or
I'll answer for myself and not ADF. Yeah. But I think out of all the tests that are out there, you know, we've got the history and tradition thing that's more in the forefront now. So I think that's an important question. How do we look at the history and tradition of free exercise? I like, you know, the whole compelling interest test. I'm generally a fan of that with parameters. I don't like the fact that almost anything could be a compelling government interest these days, because I think it waters down the free exercise right. Justice Scalia, I thought, was a great justice. Didn't agree with him on the Smith case. What was interesting to me, I thought it was more of a pragmatic or practical or policy decision by him. And that was kind of like, oh, we can't just have everybody being a law unto themselves and, you know, the sky may fall. And I don't think it did or would, because if there's something large enough or important enough, the government could still say, no, that goes too far. So there's always going to be a weighing, right? There's no absolute right to anything. Free speech, for example, there's no absolute right to speech. There's exceptions to it. There's the compelling interest test. So I would just say, I like the history and tradition. I think the compelling interest, if done correctly and not putting so much discretion in there, would be effective. But there's a lot more study that has to go into where would history and tradition leave us? What was the free exercise like back then? What is it now? And I would close by saying, on this particular point, I think the court, especially as of late, has been very protective both of free speech and freedom of religion, which I think is a good thing, because we want broad rights for all religions, no religion, all speech, even if you don't like it. you know, to have the broadest rights possible for both the free exercise of religion and free speech. And I think the law currently is maybe the broadest it's been in a long time. And I think that's a good direction for our country.
Yeah, well, turning back to the facts of this case and the government interest, how often does it, I know this issue came up with this one particular player, but how widespread in Vermont is it? Are there a lot of basketball, girls basketball teams with biological boys on them? Or is this something that, you know, came up and it's here, but it wouldn't be likely to come up again if even without this policy?
Yeah, I think it's a lot more widespread than people think. And there really is, without getting into too much of it, there's this social contagion now where, and maybe peer pressure is another good way to say it, where a lot of youngsters are experimenting with things and their friends are doing it. And so it's kind of this thing that goes on. So it's and the numbers are all over the map, depending on who you ask, but it's more prevalent than you would think. And we're seeing it all over the country in different instances, both in sports, both in schools with compelled pronouns. I just argued a case last week that I think we're going to talk about next month called Klug, where they're trying to compel the pronouns for the teachers to use the preferred pronouns of students who are identifying as transgender. So it really is an issue that's spreading nationally, never mind just in the Northeast.
Great. I just want to remind people, you can ask your questions and we will do our best to respond to them. We did have a question or a commenter before who wanted to point out that not everybody listening is necessarily a litigator. So when we use terms like PI, which means preliminary injunction, this is where David and his team went in looking for early relief in the case before the whole, you know, trial and such. So sort of a preliminary relief, asking the court for that was denied, and that's immediately appealable. And so that's why they're up in the Second Circuit. But thank you to our watcher for pointing that out. And so tell me, the court, you all raised the issue of masks, that there was a time when during COVID, some teams forfeited games because there was a basketball player who didn't have to wear a mask while playing because of a medical exemption. And other teams said, "Whoa, we don't want to play someone who's not masked." And they were not kicked out for forfeiting those games. You were kicked out for forfeiting your game. You want to explain that a little bit?
Yeah, and that's an important point, we thought, because, you know, the government has to decide what its interest is in enforcing these policies against Mid-Vermont. And so it basically said, look, our interest is we want to make sure that all students are able to play in all sports. And we said, well, look, if we're forfeiting for a religious reason and you're allowing forfeits for secular reasons, that's the differential treatment. That's what we're talking about this individualized assessment, about targeting religion, about treating religion less than secular interests, which the cases talk about. So we thought that was a pretty important point, that even though the difference is why you're forfeiting, theirs is a secular reason, ours is a religious reason, that's not a reason to distinguish the two. That's a reason to protect the religious reason because you're treating secular reasons better. And so our whole point was, look, if you're allowing forfeits for other reasons, then you have to allow forfeits for religious reasons. And they basically said, well, no, that was different because those were medical reasons and these were discrimination reasons. And that goes back to the point. I think it was Justice Gorsuch in one of the COVID cases brought this idea for, I think, the first time about level, and might even have been in Masterpiece Cake Shop, level of generality. So do you keep moving the ball of what level you're looking at? In other words, can the government interest change with every question? It's like, well, yes, the question is we want everybody to participate, and in that instance, we're not. So we'll move the level to discrimination just because of gender identity and not because of other reasons, or we'll move it to a different level. So they keep redescribing their interest based on level of generality. And in that particular instance, we thought the right level was, we're forfeiting for religious reason, they're forfeiting for secular reasons, that should be open and shut, but not an argument that carried the day yet.
Great. I've got a number of good questions coming in. One is, to what extent is Title IX implicated or argued by either party? I'm guessing Title IX wouldn't affect your client as a Christian school that wouldn't receive funding, but, well, maybe it does in Vermont, right? Because of with this funding issue. How does that play out? And how does it play out with regard to the sports league?
Yeah, and it's a good question. In this particular instance, it doesn't affect it because there isn't that funding hook. And the other reason it's really important as a question is it often does, even if there are private schools, it often does come into play. But the Title IX battle, whatever you want to call it, has been going back and forth with the administrations. So every time the administration changes, it seems like the definition of Title IX changes as far as what's required to do. What does sex mean when we're talking about Title IX, which was one of the reasons it was enacted, was to give more opportunities for girls and women to play sports. And so what does sex mean? You can't discriminate on the basis of sex in educational programs. And the argument for since it was enacted was, well, boys are boys and girls are girls, and that's what sex means. And then all of a sudden, as of the last several years, it's like, well, no, it also means gender identity. And so this does come into play. Now with the new administration, they're going back to the original view. So Title IX always has to be kept in mind for two reasons. One, what does sex mean? We obviously think it means what it meant when it was enacted, which is binary. You have males and females and that's it. But this administration, the past administration and possibly future ones may make the argument that it does include gender identity. And the Supreme Court's going to have to land on that at some point to basically clarify, you know, which one it means, because otherwise it does come into play in these types of cases.
Right. I mean, the Supreme Court's ruled on this in Title VII in the employment context, but it has not ruled on Title IX and in Fair Housing Act and some other areas where it's really open to interpretation. Another questioner asks about how the president's executive order will impact that, and that's really you've just covered that as well. Another question, the Supreme Court just granted cert in the Oklahoma charter school case. And does that have any bearing on the Saunders case?
Yeah, interestingly, so ADF is also counsel on that case. So we'll be drafting up the briefs and doing all that since cert was just granted. I'm not sure it's going to have a direct impact. So when you walk through that, there's a couple of questions at issue there. So one of them is when the state sets up this charter school program, and then it works with private organizations as it does there to allow them to open charter schools, can it say, as it did, well, any private organization could start a charter school, but a religious one can't? So that type of religious discrimination issue may have some bearing. So I don't want to completely shut it off, although it's in a different context. It very well may, because that's one of the issues here. Depending on how you look at this case, if you're going to allow exceptions for this particular rule, do you have to allow one for religion? So it very well may have some bearing on it. So it's actually a great question. We'll see how that plays out. But that's that interplay too between the free exercise clause and then does the establishment clause have something to say, whether the state establishment clause or the federal one. But we think because it's opened up to all types of charters that are secular, then the law of the free exercise clause requires it to be opened to religious charter schools too. So we'll see. That'll be an interesting case to watch. I appreciate bringing that up.
Sure. And another questioner asks, do you think this case could affect other cases matters, such as what happened at Yeshiva University with the LGBT club? I understand there was an LGBT club, and there was a PI, and then it went back. Are you familiar with that case? I'm a little rusty on the facts.
Yeah, not I am generally not as to the exact status of where it is, but I can address that. There's two different sides of things, but they're related. So here's what I mean by that. So there's kind of, you know, what can the government and what can the government force a religious school to do, whether it's in the government's own program, like you could argue there is in the Mid-Vermont case, or whether it's the religious school themselves. So they're kind of getting at the problem from opposite sides, but they probably meet at the same place in the middle. So I would say yes, It does affect it because the reach of the government's ability to say what violates the religious exercise of this particular school, whether it's participating in a government benefit or a government program, or whether it's the government reaching into the school themselves, making them do particular things. Like in this case, what if the VPA had said to Mid-Vermont, you do have to require this in your own teams also. So not only do you have to play other teams, but you also have to require this internally on your own team. That would also be an issue. So I think they will have an effect on it.
Was Yeshiva a public accommodations case? Was it New York public accommodations law, if you recall?
I believe so, because there's got to be some reach for the government to get into the private organization. Right. And the public accommodation is another important question. I don't want to go by that too quickly, because one of the arguments that the government makes is that everything you see, everybody, everywhere is a public accommodation. And the reason they make that argument is they control what they do. We like to make the argument that no, religious private organizations should not be considered public accommodations because they're specialized, they're specific in who they allow in, they have certain rules. It's not open in the sense of anybody can come and do whatever they want. There's specific rules you have to follow. Some of them have statements of faith and statements of conduct. Everybody's allowed to define it differently, which is the great thing about religious organizations. They can be as strict as they want or as permissive as they want. But what we don't want is the government telling private religious organizations of any stripe to say, this is how you have to act. This is who you have to hire. This is who you have to allow in. This is what you have to teach. And so really important issues when the government reaches in, whether it's in one of its own programs or whether it reaches into the private religious school and tries to affect its programs.
Yeah. Now, in your case, there's some sort of pointed rhetoric by the head of the sports league. And does this rise to the level of Masterpiece Cake Shop, where there's enough negative, putting aside the burden and all those things, that there was not a fair hearing and that is an animus-based reason for triggering strict scrutiny? Is that going on in your case?
It is, and I think there's plenty. I actually think there's more than in Masterpiece Cake Shop. When you look at what the Supreme Court said, one of the things it said the government can't do is opine on the legitimacy of the religious belief. And it said it was hostile because it was comparing it to like racial discrimination or things like that. Well, that's exactly what went on in this case. So first of all, they questioned the legitimacy of their beliefs. They basically said, no, you're wrong in your own beliefs, which is always interesting for the government to say. So first of all, they said you're wrong. Second of all, they gave examples of why it shouldn't violate your beliefs because there's other organizations who do other things. And then it also said that this is just a way to hurt students. This is just discrimination, you know, based on race. So when you're doubling down on those types of statements, you may have a one-off that doesn't rise. But in this instance, there's at least a half a dozen, if not more, of those type of statements. And I think when you put them together, it certainly rises to the level of the hostility and Masterpiece and probably surpasses it.
Right. Well, we've gone through all the questions. I just want to encourage anybody who has a question to post it in the Q&A. But also, I want to offer you, David, any final points that we haven't covered here before we start to wind down?
Yeah, I mean, one of the things the other side has argued, which I also think is important enough to discuss for a minute, is this a public benefit? And so they try to make the argument that, this is not a public benefit, you know, whether you're applying for some particular program, it's not open to the public at large. So you shouldn't even define it that way. And so if it's not a public benefit, you don't even go into you know, this type of analysis. One of the arguments we made based on the Trinity Lutheran case, which is a case I had the pleasure of arguing at the Supreme Court several years back, is if there is a public benefit and you say that in order to participate in this benefit, you have to give up or violate your religious beliefs, that's impermissible. Well, we're making that same argument in this case. And the reason this is a public benefit is to be defined as a public benefit doesn't mean it has to be open to literally everybody in the public. It's not what that means. In Trinity Lutheran, there was a recycling program that basically gave reimbursement grants for schools and only certain schools to be able to redo their playgrounds with a softer surface so the kids wouldn't get hurt. So it wasn't open to everybody. It was only open to certain public and private schools. And even then you would have to satisfy all these different criteria. So that exact argument was made there. It's not open to everybody. And the court said, no, it doesn't have to be open to everybody. The question is it otherwise open to you other than the fact that you're religious? And so that's the same argument here. Clearly, the VPA is open to the school. It's been a member for 30 years with no problem. So this clearly is the type of government benefit that they're allowed to participate in and are not being allowed based on Trinity Lutheran and those line of cases where they're trying to exercise their religious beliefs. But the penalty is if you follow your religious beliefs, you can no longer participate in this program, which is just another way of describing this case.
Sure. Now, we've got another question. Assuming the Second Circuit reverses, so if you were to win and grants the preliminary injunction, is that equivalent to a full win on the merits? Why or why not?
Yeah, that's always an interesting conversation in all of our cases, because that's an argument often made by the other side. And that is, well, you shouldn't grant a PI because it's a win on the merits and you shouldn't really go there. Personally, I think that argument should be taken out of the law because I don't even understand it. I don't even know why we're asking the question. And the reason I say that is, even if it was, it shouldn't matter. It shouldn't be a reason not to grant the preliminary injunction. If you've got immediate irreparable harm that can't wait, or the violation continues for months while it's being briefed or discovery being done, all that being done, that's what a preliminary injunction is for, to hold the status quo. Sometimes it may be a full win on the merits, but I don't think that should change it. So that whole conversation analysis, I don't even know why it's in the law in the first place, but that's just me. But yeah. Answer to the question is no. And the reason is there's several other issues in play. One of those is the town tuitioning is still in play because they haven't passed their final policy. Nor have they granted Mid-Vermont. They do these in 5-year increments. They're pending. So they're not even approved for the next 5 years. The VPA, in that case, the Agency of Education, said that we'll let you know when we decide, but for the interim, we'll let you remain in. So we don't even have a final decision. So that's still at issue here. On the issue about the sports, it may take care of most of the merits, depending on what they allow in. And I want to add one other thing that was interesting development as the case went on. We talked about being kicked out of all the competitions too. The district court judge pushed the VPA and said, look, it doesn't make sense. Why are you keeping Adam of the Quiz Bowl? Why are you keeping them out of all these other things that have nothing to do with this? And the VPA resisted for months. And the court pushed him pretty hard and they relented and said, okay, we'll let him back in, which is one of the reasons why that issue is not up on a PI. But maybe still at issue in the case, depending on where the court rules and what the court rules on. Because if the VPA is not required to do any of this, you could be certain that they won't. They'll definitely reverse course.
Right. We have a question about Smith. If Smith was wrongly decided, I think you covered that pretty well. I just can go back about midway through this. David addressed this. This will be up on the web if you want to watch that. But there is another question. Will there ever come a time when a citizen can object to something like the boys and girls sports problem simply on the basis of their own brains and conscience without declaring adherence to a particular religion? And this came up with the vaccine cases too, right? If you have a religious and then you have a conscience-based, where do you draw the line? What options are open to people who don't have a religious claim?
Yeah, you would like to think so, especially because, we hear a lot about science being ignored. This is a situation where those who are pushing this type of stuff on our young children are ignoring the science. It's bad everywhere around. We won't get into the depth of it. But it should be able to say, look, as a matter of common sense, as a matter of science. In fact, some of the cases that we're litigating, like, for example, I have a case in the First Circuit T-shirt case. There are only two genders. And we lost that case. And they said, well, you're offending these students because you say there are only two genders. Well, the school's science curriculum says the same exact thing. So their science curriculum could say there's only two genders, but the kid who should have more rights on his T-shirt passively says it has no right to do so. So I'm with you there. The reason the pre-exercise clause is important is it gives heightened rights. You know, people talk about the free exercise clause. Well, you should give it the same rights as at least the same rights as everybody else, kind of like these COVID cases. You get the same rights as the secular groups do. Our position is the free exercise clause gives more rights because it's a specific protection in the Constitution itself. But I agree with you. There should be a time where it's like this is harmful. Let's take, even if you took the religion out of it, you should still be able to make the objection and not have this happen, especially as experimental as it is.
We've got another question that's, I think, an important one. Can a religious school or church offer public-facing services like overnight shelter for homeless that use biological sex-based housing rules without triggering public accommodation law and or federal Housing Act issues?
It's usually state by state, and it could be both. So we actually have litigated several cases like that. In some cases, the courts will hold that it is a public accommodation because of that. Some courts will hold it is not. And the reason is, even though you're open to the public, and the Second Circuit did this, there's really a real narrow clientele that you're looking for and at. And the other important part of that question is, pick a church, right? Everyone's invited in most churches to your church service, right? It's open to the public. Are we now going to classify that church as a public accommodation? The answer should be no. It's still a private organization. It still follows its religious beliefs. So we want to be careful in saying just because you're open facing, then you lose your protections of the free exercise clause or the ability of religious autonomy, the ability to define your mission and who you file. So really important, even if you are open, because most religious organizations are trying to minister to everybody, right? Their goal is to try to help people, whether it's evangelizing, whether it's food and clothing and shelter. So real important that these religious organizations can serve the public, because it is the largest facing public service groups are the religious groups. With we had cases in Alaska with homeless shelters, which you could imagine in the winter are extremely important. And the city, sure, like Anchorage, trying to impose on them to be able to have men in the shelters with women when the women
are so important. Well, shelters are part of the ministry, right? And so it's easier to say it's not a public accommodation because it's just like the worship service in a way. Everyone's open. It's open to everybody, but this is part of our religious ministry. Right. Where you get into trouble, though, is what if you have a fellowship hall and you rent it out? Like, oh, there's some people people in the neighborhood want to have an anniversary party there. They're not members of the church, but it's nice to do for our neighbors, or they want to have dance classes here for the kids. Once you start doing that for money, you're opening yourself up to being a public accommodation when it's not your ministry. So a lot of churches, what they'll do is say, the only people who can rent are, you know, ministries that our church supports, and we will, you know, rent it out at cost to them or things like that. But that can be a tricky area.
It is. It's one of the things that the states look at to decide what is a public accommodation. And our advice to churches and religious organizations is always put parameters. So even if you do, as Eric mentions, even if you do open up for particular events, make sure you put in the contract, the agreement, that you're still able to decide what events can come. They either have to be consistent with our beliefs or at least not inconsistent with them. So even if you do open it up, you still want to put parameters. You still want to control who uses it, because the more control that you keep along with your religious beliefs, the more protection you're going to have if you're challenged later on.
You all have put out a document on this. I think I saw a few years ago, didn't you?
We do. That's absolutely right.
Okay.
Yeah, we have, just a real quick, we have documents on a lot of these types of questions. If you're a religious not-for-profit, what do you do if you're renting out your facilities? What are you allowed to do if you're a homeless shelter? What are you allowed to do if you are a religious school? So we do have all those materials.
Okay. Well, I think we've covered it all. Any last points you want to make, David, before we turn it back to Marco?
Yeah, the last thing I would say is what interested me about this, we always look at cases and their cultural impact, their protection of constitutional rights. And is it something that's happening just in this? Is this a one-off or is this something that's going to be national or even international? And clearly this issue is happening in various contexts in different ways all across the country. Each day we're getting in, people are calling us, and from coast to coast, we have a situation in California. And so this is an issue that has to be resolved. At some point, it's going to make its way in one form or another to the Supreme Court. So we don't have different rules in different states or different areas where in one area, you know, the sports are separated by biological sex and other they're not. One area, you're not compelled as a teacher to use a preferred pronoun, another one you are. And so eventually these have to percolate their way up to the Supreme Court. This issue, if you see the news in the Olympics and competitions and it comes up in all different types of sports, the good thing is I think the tide is starting to change. The other countries were way ahead of us in these types of issues and more progressive. They're actually stopping this transgender type of issues and slowing down and going back the other way. Hopefully our country and our leadership, whether at the local level or all the way up, will do the same because we think this is just harmful to kids. And so this is an issue that's not over yet. It's still growing in different areas. And I think you're still going to see this debate about the sports issue for a while to come.
Great. Well, thank you, David, for explaining this to everybody. And I've learned a lot from listening to you, and I'm sure our watchers have. And I want to thank Federalist Society and Marco Lloyd for hosting this event. Thank you, Marco.
Well, and thank you both for that fantastic discussion and the benefit of your time and expertise today. On behalf of the Federalist Society, I'd also like to thank you, our audience, for joining us. We greatly appreciate your participation. For more information on upcoming events, please visit our website or all major social media platforms at FedSoc. On that note, we are adjourned. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this episode of FedSoc Forums, a podcast of the Federal Society's Practice Groups. For more information about the Federal Society, the Practice Groups, and to become a Federal Society member, please visit our website at fedsoc.org.